self-evident.
That all men are created
equal. As a member of Congress, I get to have a lot of really interesting people in the office. Experts on what they're talking about.
This is the podcast.
For insights into the issues.
China, bioterrorism, Medicare for all. In-depth discussions.
Breaking it down into simple terms. We hold these truths. With Dan Crenshaw.
The eagle has landed.
Welcome back, everybody. As we record this, if you haven't noticed, there are still fires burning across the West, and it has been the subject of quite a debate over what causes these fires. More importantly, of course, the devastation of the fires, driving people out of their homes, causing terrible air quality for miles and miles and miles. It's really been a problem. And so the question is, how do we solve that? And I think a great person to help us answer that question here with me, Congressman Greg Walden. He represents the 2nd District in Oregon. That includes 20 counties in central, southern, and eastern Oregon. Greg, thanks so much for being on.
Hey, it's good to be back. Thanks.
So I'm going to continue maybe giving you some more bio here. You're unfortunately leaving the Congress after this term, which is a sad day for many of us. Not just because of your expertise on things like forest management, but also healthcare, drug pricing, all of the above. You're a lifelong
Oregonian.
Okay, thank you for that, Oregonian, whose ancestors came to Oregon by wagon in 1845.
Yeah.
You spent 2 decades as a radio station owner and an amateur radio operator. So you've been working on this forest management issue for quite a while, trying to bring some common sense to the conversation. How's that been going when you look at the statements of politicians in Oregon and California?
Yeah, it's frustrating because, as you said, my district's one of the biggest ones. It was stretched from the Atlantic to Ohio. 55% of it is federal forest and Bureau of Land Management land. So we deal a lot with the federal agencies. And I've, for 22 years been in the House, lifelong Oregonian, love our forests, love the clean water of our streams and rivers and all of that. And then you see it go up in smoke. And look, fire's part of nature, right? You're going to get fire. What's not natural, though, anymore is after 100 years of very aggressively fighting forest fires, Smokey Bear, all the assets we throw at fires every year, about 50 years ago, federal policy and court decisions really moved us in a direction where we still put out fires, but we stopped managing forests. So if you think about never mowing your lawn, never thinning your garden, never pruning your trees, forests are not static. They continue to grow dynamically and die. And so the fuel loads are enormous and completely out of balance. Mm-hmm. I've got researchers from Oregon State University's School of Forestry that will tell you there are in some plots in my district 1,000 trees per acre where there should be about 10. Because you see, Mother Nature used to come in every year or every couple of years, kind of thin things out with fire. Mm-hmm. But because the fuel loads were lower, it didn't destroy everything in its path. It just cut out the underbrush, basically.
Yeah.
Ladder fuels never developed. And occasionally you have stand replacement fires. You get that in lodgepole. It's how you get a new lodgepole stand. Basically, the fire and the heat opens the pine cones and the seeds, and they germinate. So some forest regimes, fire is part of it. Others, though, it's different. And in the meantime, people have moved into what we call the wildland-urban interface. They love to live out you're
right
in forests.
And they don't want to see any fires when they're out there.
Right. And now you get changing conditions. You can ascribe that to climate change. You can ascribe that to some years of unusual drought. I don't care. It's changing. And you have enormous fuel loads. And so when you get a fire, it is catastrophic. And that's what we're seeing through the West right now.
What's the state of the fire now? Is it been somewhat under control?
Well, it's multiple fires in Oregon, I think California as well. But we've had multiple fires that have burned right at or over 1 million acres. Now, what's 1 million acres? That's bigger than the size of the entire state of Rhode Island.
Yeah.
So it's a big chunk of ground. 1 million acres, big. And we're not done with our fire season as we have this discussion. It usually goes until the fall rains that are sometime in the mid to end of October. We're starting to finally get a little rain. But in the West, we dry out in the summer. Mm-hmm. And we don't get a lot of rain with our thunderstorms. We get a lot of lightning, and they call it dry lightning. And, you know, here on the East Coast, where we work on our day jobs in Congress, you know, you get the afternoon thunderstorm and a foot of rain or whatever it is. It feels like that, not in the West. So it's we're trying to get these fires out. And then there's a lot of work to be done after the fire.
Well, what's the logic that the environmentalists use to not touch forests and not manage them and to put these regulations in place that would prevent us from doing so?
Well, there are some in the extreme environmental movement who have convinced people not familiar with active forest management mm-hmm. that the best thing you can do for the natural environment is leave it alone, lock it up, walk away.
Right.
Well, we do that. They're called wilderness areas, and a high propensity of our fires often start and rumble around in wilderness areas because federal law basically says leave it alone, let it burn, and they do in many cases. Unfortunately, it comes roaring out of the wilderness area and then devours the communities and forests around. So, I mean, that's their deal. They scare people, frankly. I think a lot of their claims over the years are phony and fake, but it raises money. I've witnessed it firsthand, and so there are some of these national organizations. I think it's literally about the money, and they convince people who aren't familiar with our way of life in the West that they know better and to lock it up and leave it.
Yeah, I'm always trying to delve down into the motivations of groups like this, because if it was truly caring about the environment, you would think that they would really do a logical analysis of what's working for the environment and what isn't.
Yeah.
Because obviously when there's a massive forest fire, I think there was one study that showed that one fire season emitted more carbon dioxide than the entirety of cars and electricity in California for 1 year.
In fact, I have that statistic right here.
Yeah, there you go.
In 2018, the California wildfires emitted 68 million tons of CO2. That's the equivalent of a year's worth of electricity from California. Emissions in Oregon in 2015, that's just a year we happen to have the data on, equaled the emissions from 3 million cars or 3.5 coal-fired plants. So right. So if you care about emissions, you should care more about these fires that burn unnaturally hot and destructive.
Yeah, I mean, in bringing the conversation up to the 30,000-foot level, you know, if we were actually caring about carbon emissions because we believe that carbon emissions result in some form of climate change, then you would want the biggest bang for your buck as far as reducing carbon emissions. And it would turn out that that forest management has a pretty big impact on that. I think the IPCC, an intergovernmental panel on climate change from the UN, said that forest management would have an enormous impact for a few reasons, right. It seems. One, if you're reducing fires, but also if you're managing it, then that means you have younger, healthier forests, which when they do burn, emit less carbon, would seem to make sense.
So here's an important statistic around that. A couple of them. According to the chief of the Forest Service, nationally there are 63 million acres of our federal forest lands that are at risk of uncharacteristically severe wildfire and in need of treatment, such as thinning or actually prescribed fires. Mm-hmm. 7.2 million of that's in Oregon. But you have to know they only treat 4 to 6 million acres a year, and that's about a 20 or 25% increase during the Trump administration over the Obama administration. But you do the math. If you got 63 million acres uncharacteristically out of balance with nature and at high risk of uncharacteristically severe wildfire, and you're only treating 4 to 6 million acres a year, you're a decade behind at least if you did it all now. But these forests continue to grow and die, so the volume continues. They're not static. So that's one. Two, I've read that IPCC report on climate change and the forestry part especially. And one of the things to know is that there are scientists who estimate 70% of carbon emissions occur after a wildfire as the burned dead debris decays. Mm. You know, so we should be getting in there and cleaning out where appropriate. You're not going to do it everywhere, but where appropriate, get the burned dead trees out while they still have value. It's what private landowners do. It's what counties do. It's what the state does. Tribes do. Federal government, they don't.
Yeah.
I mean, they'll claim they do a little here and there, but it's nominal. It's hazard trees along roads. And because the federal system is so litigious It takes years to do the planning, get it through, and by then the trees have no value. They've got, they're bug infested and rotted, right, and dangerous, frankly, and ready for fuel for another fire. The other thing we don't do is come in after the fires and plant a new healthy green forest. Everybody else does it, not the federal government. We are a slumlord when it comes to managing our forests.
That's a great way to put it. Should we be engaging in more lumberjacking and using, you know, using wood for natural resources?
Well, I mean, it's amazing. You know, your table here on which these microphones sit is a great carbon sink. It appears to be a wooden table.
Right.
Trees sequester carbon. That's what gives you wood, in effect. And you sequester it in your desk here and your table and all of that. And it creates jobs. Mm-hmm. And it would pay for restoration. In fact, our colleague Bruce Westerman has legislation to do exactly all of that. And I've helped lead that fight over the years successfully to give us more tools for our scientists to manage our forests better. And we made some progress, but holy smokes, we got a long way to go.
But people just can't stand the idea of a big chainsaw cutting down a big, beautiful tree. And it's
a dead one.
And it seems hard to persuade them that, no, this is right, in the long term, in the bigger picture, this is actually good for the forest, good for carbon emissions. And, you know, it's simply a part of forest management.
Well, and if you think about it again, back to the gardening analogy, if you plant a row of carrot seeds or radish seeds or whatever, you go in and thin those out and then you get bigger, healthier carrots or radishes or whatever else, lettuce, you name it. The forests are no different than that. And so they get overstocked over time. And if Mother Nature's been precluded from doing sort of regular forest management by fire, mm-hmm, and then you keep human management out, oh, but by the way, you've injected humans to live in the forest environment in many areas, you got a real prescription for the very kind of disasters we're seeing year after year.
Do we need more personnel out there? I mean, I remember visiting Mount Rushmore recently and seeing the pictures of, I think it was the Conservation Corps under Teddy Roosevelt.
CCC.
Do we need a lot more burly men out there chopping with axes, big beards? Burly, I mean, would that?
You know, we've kind of advanced slightly past that. Yeah. We have chainsaws and things. Look, we need to do more active management, yes. There was a day and time when that more than paid for itself and put money in the federal coffers. But we've made it so restrictive and litigious. And I mean, we got in the Blue Mountain Forest, we went back to the 1996 Forest Management Plan because after more than 20 years and millions of dollars trying to write a new 10-year plan, they scrapped it and we got to start over again. So, I mean, the planning process is a joke and a mess, and it's very expensive. And meanwhile, the forests grow and expand and catch fire and die. So, yes, we need more active management in the forests. We need to be able to do timber sales. We need to replant after fires. We need to remove the burned dead timber while it still has value where appropriate after a fire and create wood products and jobs here in the U.S. All of that needs to happen.
What are the chances that our Democrat colleagues understand this and will help get through? I mean, you've got various pieces of legislation proposed on this. You talked about Bruce Westerman's proposed legislation. Is there any chance that's bipartisan?
And just as a footnote, Bruce Westerman, for your listeners, has a degree in forestry from Yale.
Yeah.
He's not just some politician thinking he knows what he's doing on forest management. He actually is a forester, Yale-trained forestry manager. And so I think he knows what to do, and I think his legislation makes sense. Look, the Democrats want it both ways. Not all of them, but many of them. They want to appease their hardcore environmental base. Mm-hmm. So that means they can't vote for a Westerman bill or some of these things. And yet I heard one the other day said, this is the result of decades of lack of forest management. The bill has finally come due. This particular politician has fought virtually every reform we've tried to move through. But then when the fires happen and lives are lost and thousands of homes are destroyed, it's like, we got to do more on forest management. Well, then get out of the way or help. One of the two. But they want it both ways. And I've just always tried to speak truth to power and just say, we got to change the law.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean you do it everywhere across the landscape. I mean, and every landscape's different. You know, even in Oregon, we've got the wet side of Oregon by the coast, and the Coast Range, and the west flank of the Cascade Range. by the time you get to my side of Oregon, which is two-thirds of it, you're down to about 9 to 10 inches of rain. It's pretty dry. That that dry forest environment's different, so you manage differently. We need a management regime for each type of forest, so we get it right.
Yeah, and we notice most of this happens on federal land. Like you said, I guess we're slumlords as federal operators, but it doesn't happen on private land as much.
We do get fires on private land. They often are able to get them out quicker because they've managed them better. But fire is a pretty nasty thing. You get a strong wind and a big fire on after months of no rain, and you know, everything's in the path. But they do more aggressively get them out. They tend to have more fire breaks. They tend to thin out their forests, so fire will drop to the ground and not run across the canopy. So, I mean, there are different styles, different management. And I don't know. We did a hearing up in the Colville area of northeast Washington years ago after the schoolhouse fire. And the tribal lands there were immediately doing recovery work. I remember asking one of the tribal foresters, somebody told me their logs were actually still smoking on the log trucks. He said, yeah, that probably wasn't the best thing. But that's how quickly they were in there.
Yeah.
And so then you replant. So you're taking care of the next generation.
Yeah.
Federal Forest Service, God bless them. But their hands are often tied or they bend or litigated or yield to the other side, and they just can't get much done.
It's so weird. So like they litigated or bending to the other side, meaning that the other side doesn't want them to touch anything ever.
Right.
Post-fire, pre-fire, none of it. It's nature. It's only beautiful if you leave it alone, kind of thing.
I had a conversation with a incident commander recently, which I found to be pretty disturbing. And he said, oh, we can't cut our way out of here. We got to let these fires burn. Now, this is one of the incident commanders charged with putting these fires out. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, no, fire is part of a tool. And I said, well, but in August or September, when it's windy and hot and dry all across the West, doesn't seem like a very good time to let the fires rumble around out there. And, you know, anyway, it's one of those you just shake your head at. And my uncle was a fire boss back in the 60s. They went out and put out these fires.
Yeah.
And we didn't have the gigantic ones we're seeing today because, frankly, I would argue they were more aggressive at putting them out.
Right.
And they had lower fuel loads. And they had, to your point, they had loggers out in the woods who always had their own firefighting equipment along with them. They'd have a small tanker. And those loggers were immediately conscripted, if you will, to put out the fire. And plus, they were out there.
Yeah. And as far as the origins of this, because, again, every time this happens, everybody on the left screams climate change. It's right. I think a good analogy that I came up with here is, it's like your boat is sinking in the middle of the ocean because there's a bunch of holes in it. Instead of plugging the holes, you start to claim that we should lower the level of the ocean.
Yeah, you don't drown.
Yeah, and it's crazy. And studies have been done on this. I had Michael Schellenberger on this podcast a few episodes ago, and he pointed out that studies show that it doesn't mean climate change isn't happening. It doesn't mean that it doesn't intensify some of the fires. If things are drier and hotter at a given moment, you're going to have a more intense fire. Whether that's related to climate change is a question in and of itself. But if there's a pattern, we can assume that there might be. If there's a trend, we can assume that there might be. But even then, the studies show overwhelmingly that it's a tiny percentage of difference, and that the vast majority of difference in fire intensity comes from lack of forest management and fuel that is on the forest floor.
I couldn't agree more. And that's why, I think we can tell things are changing. Scientists will tell us that. Fine. But if you look at the adjustments that you would need to make to bring down temperature, most all the data indicate the impact wouldn't show up for 50 to 100 years.
And it'd be a tiny impact at that.
Exactly.
You know, yeah.
And to your
which
point,
is why I use the ocean thing.
So we start plugging the holes in the boat
sink? Exactly.
We know from the IPCC reports, active forest management is a good thing to reduce emissions from forest fires. Mm-hmm. We know that a healthy green forest sequesters more carbon than a dead, dying, decay forest. We know that we have this out-of-balance system with 1,000 trees per acre where you should have 100. we have the resources to go do this. Could we please start?
Yeah.
And so the Trump administration has, I mean, they've increased their active forest management by 20-25%, harvest by 20-25%. But these forests are growing much more rapidly than that would allow us to even catch up, let alone stay current.
What's interesting, this is a somewhat related note, but something I read about, and it just gets to the absurdity of the solutions from the environmentalist, climate change alarmist left. And for instance, designating biofuel as a net zero fuel, which is, people don't realize that. I only discovered this in the last, I think, few weeks. Might have been something that, again, Michael Schellenberger brought to my attention. So when like Germany, for instance, says that they're reducing carbon emissions, and it's because they're shifting so much to biofuels, meaning they're buying American wood, they're burning American wood, which burns more carbon than say, you know, gas, and especially natural gas, especially for what it actually provides in terms of energy. But they're claiming it's carbon neutral because the idea is that you'll eventually plant more trees. But this is absurd. this is such an absurd.
But that's actually better than what we do here. We treat the government wants to treat woody biomass as if it were coal.
Okay.
Well. So it's actually even worse here. And so we have these pretty high efficiency woody biomass burners that emit virtually nothing. But when it comes to this was my favorite. When we had the old Waxman-Markey predecessor to the Green New Deal, the cap-and-trade bill the Democrats tried to pass through the Congress before they lost their majority in part over that, they had this preposterous argument that woody biomass off of private ground was renewable energy.
Okay.
And, you know, it fit within their theories of carbon capture and all that. Oh, but woody biomass off the federal forest, Oh, no, that couldn't be it. Unless the tree was injured and damaged. I mean, I took him through this tortured knothole because it's like, okay, you want to be the party of science. Yeah. Show me the science that says a tree that we grind up off the federal forest is different than the one we grind up into woody biomass off the private forests that are standing within a foot of each other. Show me that. I'm just curious about that science, right? Because their environmental left doesn't want any activity on the forest, federal forest ground.
Right, right.
They can't, they're trying to stop it everywhere, but they can't, that's where the rub was. Yeah. And that was the dichotomy they were in politically. And so then they went through this tortured rewrite and this definition. I had a forest manager tell me, how would I ever implement this?
It's insane. I see this across so many issues where there's this sort of utopia that they've built in their heads. And then they engage in some kind of cognitive gymnastics to try and get to that utopia. But there's no linear thinking involved in any of this. It's usually contradictory and it's usually, you know, outright insane. But they attempt it anyway.
Well, you know, I've talked about the regulatory frameworks that we have to operate under. And a lot of that has to do with the environmental impact statements or an EA or an EIS, as we say.
Yeah, I wanted to get to that. It's like you read my mind.
It takes forever, and then it's litigated. So the average time to conduct an environmental impact statement is 4.5 years, and federal highway projects average over 7.
Yeah.
Okay. Canada, Germany, Australia, other countries such as that take 2 years, and they still rank higher than the U.S. on Yale University's Environmental Performance Index. And it costs us about $3.7 trillion in foregone economic gains and employment compared to these countries.
Yeah, it's like we're just trying to have a lose-lose situation.
You and I aren't trying to Yes. And that's where, the Trump administration under the CEQ has gone back and looked at this and said, where did we get so out of bounds
here compared to what? The Council on Environmental Quality.
Correct. Yeah. And so Mary Neumeier, who heads that, used to be on the Energy and Commerce Committee staff. Terrific. Person, and she's done a great job of going back to the original intent of NEPA, the National Environmental Protection Act. And said, you know, they haven't updated those rules basically since it was written back in the 1970s.
And so NEPA, let's bring it down a notch here. So NEPA, that National Environmental Protection Act, it is a regulatory framework that tells us how to build things and protect the environment. In the simplest of terms. Yeah. Okay. I just want to make sure our listeners got to know that.
And it's basically a touchstone to say, what you're about to do, does it have an impact, a negative impact on the environment?
Right.
And if so, how do you offset against that?
It
started out as kind of a common sense concept.
Sure.
Oh my gosh. Now, as I said, 4.5 years on average, but a lot of these go even, and once they're done with it, then these environmental groups are all set to litigate. And they know it. You talk to anybody in the federal land management system, that's Forest Service, BLM, Corps of Engineers, they'll tell you, well, we got to do all this because we know we'll get sued.
Yeah, and they end up with thousands of pages of nonsense, using their imaginations to think, well, if we built this off-ramp, I mean, you never know what could happen to the sea turtle in California just because the car that leaves the off-ramp might run over a turtle. You know, I don't think there's an example of that ridiculous, but like it sort of gets to that sort of imagination.
I could get to a couple of those. I had a forest ranger tell me she had to do an analysis on the aquatic impact, so impact on fish, of replacing the steps on a fire lookout tower.
I can't even follow that. Okay.
So a fire lookout tower is on top of a ridge somewhere, highest point you could possibly get, and they needed to replace the steps. And she had to evaluate the replacement of those steps, which is like the steps off your deck.
Yeah.
At the impact that would have on fish. This is what you're paying for. And she's like, and there are like 99 other things I have to evaluate. So something in there will conflict, and I'll get something not quite right, and then I'm open to litigation. And by the way, under the Equal Access to Justice Act, when they do sue, if they get anything right, they can get all their attorney's fees paid for. So it's an ATM machine for the left. And so that's a problem. And we can't even get from the federal agencies how much they pay out of that ATM machine. Yeah. They weren't keeping track of it. We're finally getting, under this administration, the first look at those data. Taxpayers are getting fleeced on these lawsuit payouts. And so there's a whole industry out there teed up to sue. And so we've tried to rein that in a bit over the years, the Healthy Forest Restoration Act that became law, that basically said a project done under that framework, you have to substantively participate in order to have standing to sue.
Yeah.
So now you can't just mail it in from, you know, New York City when the project was being, you know, everybody at the table from all sides working it out in, you know, Grants Pass, Oregon or something. So there's a lot in this that's way, way beyond.
It's so beyond.
You wonder why
we
have fires? I don't wonder why we have fires.
Well, it's also, you wonder why we can't build our new bridges. Everybody keeps, you know, clamoring over the crumbling bridges and roads. But and I remember this transportation or infrastructure bill that we voted on not too long ago. And the reason a lot of us voted against it was because it simply makes it harder to build infrastructure. You can't make it harder and then claim that you want to spend a bunch of money.
Well, they're going to move an energy bill as we sit here recording this that even goes farther and opens the door to even more review and litigation and objection opportunities.
Right.
That as we read the text, which, by the way, has never really been vetted in any committee. They brought it straight to the floor. No due process. Right. We think could put a nail in the coffin of virtually any energy development project. I mean, I've had enough experience in the forestry side to look at this and go, oh my gosh.
Yeah, you know, it's very anti-pipeline. It's anti-building anything new. You can't claim you're pro-infrastructure, which the majority of Americans are, right? This is the one thing I thought we had some bipartisan agreement on. The Democrats, I think, have lied to the American people's face on this. I do want to read something from that bill that you just mentioned, the new clean energy bill. Now, I will say, I will caveat this with, there's a lot of really good stuff in the clean energy bill that's bipartisan, and it's just so unfortunate that we can't just move that stuff through. I think I'm trying to get one of my bills, the New Energy Frontier, put in as an amendment. There's some pro-nuclear stuff in there that's pretty good. But there's one of my staffers just brought this to me. There's one section in the bill that says that the principles of environmental justice will be upheld, the 17 principles. It's so interesting. It's so random. And it doesn't list what the 17 principles are in the bill. It just says they will be upheld. So we looked up what those are. I believe this was written back in 1991, but this is how it starts. We, the people of color, gather together at the Multinational People of Color Environmental Leadership Summit to begin to build a national and international movement of all peoples of color to fight the destruction and taking of our lands and communities do hereby reestablish our spiritual independence to the sacredness of our Mother Earth. Such an interesting sort of a pagan document. One of the first environmental justice principles: affirm the sacredness of Mother Earth, ecological unity, and the interdependence of all species, and the right to be free from ecological destruction. Most of this is just sort of like, you know, just nonsense. Not exactly meaning anything. But there's a couple things in here. For instance, basically eliminating nuclear.
Right.
So is
carbon-free baseload power nuclear.
Yeah. And it says it right here. And it just begs the question of like what the true intention is of the left on these things. Eliminating nuclear is the last thing you would actually do if you cared about providing energy to people and reducing carbon emissions. And yet they're very contradictory on these things.
Plus they want to remove dams.
Remove dams.
All right. So in California recently had their rolling brownout blackouts. The Snake River dams, which these same people want to pull out on the Snake River that flows into the mighty Columbia River, they increased output capacity by 50,000 megawatt hours and 25%. Now, there's a limit how far we can go because of other requirements on the flow of that water through the system. Had we not done that, I don't know what would have happened to the California grid, but I do know they would have been without enough power to operate. Mm-hmm. Now, the same parties that are for all these other things you're reading about are fighting tooth and nail, and they have a federal judge on their side to try and rip out those very Snake River dams that provide clean, carbon-free hydropower.
Yep.
All right? Then they want to shut down nuclear. Clean, carbon-free power. And wind and solar, look, I helped start the Renewable Energy Caucus years ago here in the Congress. I'm for renewable energy. But in my playbook, it's like one ingredient in the recipe.
Yeah.
Wind, great. Solar, fine. Geothermal in my part of the state, we could develop a lot of.
Yeah.
Hydro, and we've done legislation when I chaired the Energy and Commerce Committee to expedite small-scale hydro. So now we're talking irrigation ditches, and you put that in pipe, you develop a head on it, and it produces electricity. You don't have the lost water, so we had water for fish, and the irrigators had a pressurized system. Mm-hmm. So there's you can make this so it works for everybody, but that's not what they're doing here. Those things you read, you don't think the creative trial bar won't figure out a way to hook onto one of those and litigate? Oh, you didn't look at that one. You didn't look at the impact of that when you tried to cite that power line. Oh, by the way, they're against all that too. But if we don't reinforce our power grid, you can't manage the stop and start of energy from solar and wind if you don't have a dynamic grid. Well, they're going to set up a framework where you couldn't put a power pole in the ground. Back to our NEPA stuff. I had a little town in my district several years ago trying to get, for the first time, three-phase power. Mm-hmm. Think 220, right? Three-phase power, first time. I think there were four power poles that needed to cross federal land. Mm-hmm. It took over 3 years to do the environmental analysis so they could put those four power poles in BLM ground.
Wow. And, you know, people listening who are who would consider themselves environmentalists, who would even maybe vote based on an environmental issue, I don't think imagine that this is the extent of our regulations, right?
Yeah, because you know
it does. Yeah, it the problem with these things is these stories, they affect so few people, and even the people they do affect, I'm not sure. You know, people are just frustrated. They don't understand the policy implications or the background or what kind of rhetoric. And it really, you know, it all boils down to cultural rhetoric leads to this craziness. And now, of course, there are people pulling the strings who do understand it.
That's right.
And again, it's the kind of people who would be against nuclear and hydro and even geothermal, but for solar and wind. And you've just got to question the motivations here because
and who's funding it.
Yeah.
And they hide behind the non-disclosure of some of these organizations. And you wonder who's really pushing American energy policy this direction.
It's really sick because it's easy to debunk the entire thing. Now, it takes some time. I've spent a lot of time doing it. It's why we have these conversations on this podcast. It's why I've had many other experts on on this, because, and I think there is slowly an awakening to kind of the truth behind the dogmatic obsession with wind and solar. It's just not a good resource, or it's not a good source of energy. It's low in energy density. It can work in some places for certain things.
Yeah.
But this push to make it universal is utterly insane. And bad for the environment.
What I look at, Dan, is this. You're out in the Nevada desert outside of Las Vegas, where the sun shines 300 and some days a year, right? Solar works, and the efficiencies are up, and you know, the prices are down. And we're getting to a point where, okay, but I'm not going to mandate that in every state, because you get some states, you don't have that kind of solar, yeah. Right? My part of Oregon, we get a lot of wind. But I'll drive through these big wind farms on days when nothing's moving.
Yeah.
So that's not your base load. You don't have solar at night, right? So that's not your base load power. And so you need a mix here. Geothermal could give you base load, but a lot of that's on, again, in the West on federal ground.
Certain,
so now you're back
places.
To your NEPA and all that.
Well, the geology needs to be correct.
Correct.
And there's only certain places.
Yeah, and then you've got to connect it into the grid. Look, what I'm excited about is small-scale nuclear.
Yeah.
Because I think there's an opportunity for a revolution in nuclear power that will be even safer, cleaner, and smaller.
What about changing the law to allow more highly enriched uranium to be used for that? You think that's on the table? Have you ever looked at that option?
I don't know. A little bit. I don't claim to be an expert in that area. I don't hear that that's really the issue at hand. It is more we just have, we've not reimagined nuclear power until now. Mm-hmm. And there's a company called NuScale is working its way through the approval process. And if that works, now you're talking small nuclear, not these giant plants.
Right.
In fact, you could probably move them around on a rail car or two and have regional-based nuclear power that doesn't have the sort of systems we're used to, right, in terms of safety protocols and the big cooling towers and all that. It's much more contained, much smaller, and yet can produce a lot of electricity. So there's some exciting things on the cusp there. It needs to be affordable. Here's something you should delve into in one of your podcasts. Simple question. In all of this debate, who's looking out for what it costs consumers? Mm-hmm. Consumers don't have many advocates anymore when it comes to power rates.
Yeah.
The left that used to carry that cudgel, if you will, for consumers somehow isn't there when it comes to price anymore.
Yeah.
They're all about just going down the Green New Deal, the AOC version, the Markey version. It's all about that. And there really isn't somebody saying, but wait, oh, what about the cost to consumer here?
Why have
we left that behind?
They don't do second and third order consequences in anything. They pretend those don't exist.
That's right.
This is the big trick of the left, and I wish people really need to wake up to it in America, because it really is sending us down a bad path. Because the left gets bolder. They get bolder with these sort of false statements like, hey, we've got a solution that the government's just been hiding from you. And there's no trade-offs. You don't have to pay anything.
Freezing.
There's no trade-offs at all. And that's just not true. That's not true in anything in your life.
That's right.
There are no trade-off-free solutions. You could argue there aren't really, technically speaking, solutions. There's just trade-offs in life.
Right.
That's a rule that you have to live by in your own life. And for some reason, the Democrat Party has been able to persuade voters that that is not how we have to govern. And it's a utopianistic kind of thinking. And really what it is it's buying people off with false promises. They do it with the environment. They do it with healthcare. They do it with all sorts of things. And it's deeply frustrating and dishonest.
Yeah, and I think you want to get to the Green New Deal and the Paris Accords and all of that. Basically, when we were in complete COVID-19 lockdown, we almost achieved the emission reduction levels called for by some of these agreements.
Yeah.
Now, that's not the economy that I don't think we want.
No.
Because there wasn't any economy.
Hasn't been great. No.
And so I think that was a bit of a wake-up call. And I had my team at the Energy and Commerce Committee take a look at that. And basically, we were pretty close when everything was shut down. And I remember when everything was shut down and I had to fly back here and going through, I think it was the airport in Las Vegas on one leg. It was like me, three other passengers, cleaning crew, a couple of TSA people, and flight crew. And that was all that was in McCarran Airport. Yeah. Nobody in the parking lots, nobody driving around. Actually, it was great to get around because nobody but me, nobody but I was driving. But I don't think that's what will sustain our American way of life.
Right.
A complete shutdown of the economy. And yet to get to the emission levels some of these advocates want and do it overnight, that's the economy we would have to have.
It would be. And the question that they're never asked, and if, you know, the press and the media and frankly the entirety of the American people wanted to ask the right questions, it would be, what is the benefit going to be? If you really go along this track, well, the cost is enormous, right? We can ascertain that. We can definitely know that. Now they will claim, but you're still saving things in the long run because of the cost of climate change. Of course, they use really like misleading numbers to make that. But even the benefit, it's like, what, you know, just going back to, if you reduce it by this much, you know, how much are you really reducing temperatures, and what is that even? What is the effect even on the climate? They don't like to answer that question because it's so minuscule and probably not even noticeable. They don't like to answer it. They just say, no, you just avoid the doomsday. Well, these doomsday models are often wrong. They're based on modeling, and you change a few factors and it can change wildly. They when they implement cost and where they talk about the cost of climate change, they love to say that it's the cost to human lives from, say, heat deaths. And this has been thoroughly debunked, because the logic they try to use is this. Okay, Houston is, you know, this hot in the summer. In 100 years, Philadelphia will be just as hot as Houston in the summer. So they claim that heat deaths in Philadelphia will somehow go up by like 50-fold. Does that make sense to anybody? Like, no, of course not. You know, because in Houston, we've been fine. It's very hot, and we don't have these heat deaths.
The hurricanes and 5 feet of rain.
Right. So where is this? And so yeah. and then they have a statistical value of each life, right. And so then they times that by the number of supposed heat deaths. You can pick apart that logic rather quickly, and that's where they're coming up with these large numbers. People don't realize this. You know, we had Orrin Cass actually did a whole study on this. Is how I know about this, and we had him in the budget committee. To debunk this entire thing. It was fascinating.
Yeah, and I don't know. It's the whole thing. I in the Energy and Commerce Committee, I said, okay, let's stipulate for the moment, climate change is real and we contribute. All right, let's all agree to that. Now let's talk about what we do about it and what that costs. And as Republicans, we're for conservation. I mean, Teddy Roosevelt, Republican president, one of the first conservationists around, but he also believed in active forest management as a way to build homes. You replant afterwards and you protect the watersheds. That was his theory of forestry. And then we're for adaptation. You know, everybody's having to adapt, right? We have for generations. By the way, for tens of thousands of years, I think some of the Great Lakes in the West, carved out by glaciers that then melted, stopped. You got the moraines on either end and sides and, you know, it's kind of what nature did. We don't have 500 feet ice anymore. We've been melting. We've been warming over time, long before we showed up on the scene with cars and whatever else. So adaptation makes sense. And then innovation. Mm-hmm. And I think innovation is really the key here. If you allow American ingenuity to have its way, we'll find ways to reduce emissions and grow our economy. It can be done. But when you drive their Green New Deal concept, they get ahead of themselves, cost $93 trillion or some figure, and it puts the cart ahead of the horse. It just doesn't, they're not ready, science isn't there, innovation's not there. I'd rather go the other way. Let's invest in our systems so we develop the world leading edge on battery storage. You know, a grid-sized battery storage. We're not there yet, but our scientists at the labs, whether that's in the Tri-Cities of Washington or Los Alamos or somewhere, they're working on these things. Let's us be the world leader on new nuclear power that's even more efficient, more productive, and more affordable. And then let's export that to the world and make money and jobs with new innovation. And so I think there's a lot we could do here to achieve reductions of emissions, grow our economy, and be the world leader in innovation.
Yeah. I mean, I would argue even a step further that the Green New Deal increases emissions worldwide. And I come at that conclusion because, you know, first of all, even if you just destroy the U.S. economy with the Green New Deal and we are all of a sudden emitting nothing, so that's 15% of global emissions. whether you like it or not,
China gets off the hook.
China gets off the hook, and energy demand around the world still goes up 25% over the next 20 years. So somebody's providing that. And unless you start, unless your next plan is to invade developing countries and force them to use solar and wind instead of letting them come out of poverty using fossil fuels, unless that's your plan, they're going to do it because that's how you actually get out of poverty. And so there's a very, there's a moral question here that we don't always bring up, which is why are you trying to eliminate growth and prosperity for for billions of poor people around the world? They're going to need either natural gas or oil to burn in order to create electricity. Well, and then the Russians and Saudis are going to provide that. And guess what? They do it a lot dirtier than we do.
That's right.
So this is my argument that it's going to be dirtier. It's going to be a dirtier future if you just eliminate American energy independence.
Well, and isn't it interesting? As they finish their 2 years in power in the House, they've never brought the Green New Deal up for a vote.
Yeah.
I've asked them to. Said, hey, that's your, you ran on it in the elections. You promised your base Green New Deal is the way to go. You know, AOC and Ed Markey, this is their big thing. They had their big news conference. They control all the levers of power in the House.
Yeah.
Have you seen a vote on it? I haven't seen a vote on it.
No. Well, but what worries me, though, is they sort of are, in a sense. Because, I mean, the Green New Deal itself is like, you know, it's Medicare for all. It's free housing. It's all this crazy stuff. On the environmental side, they sort of are by attacking pipe. I mean, they're doing it in this bill that we just talked about. Right?
Like, but so they're trying to sub rosa.
Right. Yeah, no, it's very sneaky. They're not going to say, hey, we outright ban fracking. We're just going to regulate it out of existence.
That's right.
There's a, you know, it's the same outcome.
It's the frog in the pot of cold water.
Right.
And they're just turning the heat up.
Yeah. And that's what they'll do. And meanwhile, again, throwing subsidies at solar and wind and, you know, I'm all for just neutral treatment of technologies, but solar and wind have to be able to compete and be used where they make sense. And I think this is where the left really gets it wrong, because they're happy to destroy the environment, building acres and acres of wind farm and solar farms, and then build hundreds of miles of transmission lines using rare earth minerals and all these things. There's a ton of environmental impact here that is not calculated, by the way, into the solar and wind when they do calculate it into nuclear. So it's really not fair.
And meanwhile, it's the same entities that are banning mining for where the rare earth minerals are. So now we're reliant on China.
Right.
How's that work during COVID? We found out for sure how they treat us when they control the supply chains. So I mean, it's just, it's really, really frustrating.
So let me ask you one last question before we end. We talked about NEPA. The Trump administration is trying to reform a lot of these crazy NEPA regulations that make it impossible to build a set of stairs on a mountaintop, right? Or that off ramp, you know, again, most regular people would be like, just build the off ramp. The highway is already there. Like, what do we, you know, why do we, what impact is there going to be? Any common sense person would know that. People don't realize it takes years to actually get that approved. This is a big deal for us in Houston because of, you know, flood mitigation infrastructure. We can't afford to deal with this stuff on end. So the Trump administration has done a lot to try and fix this and bring it back to more of a common sense policy. What are the chances that sticks around if Biden becomes president?
Huh. Oh, no. You've got it wrong. Not only doesn't it stick around, you go and reverse it.
You go make it worse.
Because that's what they're promising people. We're going to, you know, I mean, didn't Biden call Trump a climate arsonist and try and blame him for these fires?
Yeah.
I mean, for gosh sakes, 8 years, I was here under 8 years of Obama and his administration. They tried to shut down every forest management thing known to humankind. It was George W. that signed our Healthy Forest Restoration Act and really was moving us forward. And the Obama-Biden team show up, and we go into reverse. I mean, and so, my gosh,
And they've only gotten more extreme since then.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, this is not the party of Barack Obama.
No. Or Bill, or certainly not
Bill Clinton. Definitely not Bill Clinton.
And one of the most active forest management times in our history in the last 60 years occurred during Jimmy Carter. Mm-hmm. That's when they really got in and managed forests. But remember, Georgia has pretty active forests down there, a lot of private forests, but there are some public. But his Forest Service chief was terrific, and they did active management, and, you know, we harvested trees and planted new ones. Remember, when you have a contract to go harvest on the federal land, you have a requirement to plant four or five trees per what you cut so that you get survival rates, and you have to do that. But when fire comes roaring through there, there's no money and there's no requirement to plant a new forest. So all that burned debris sits there, and frequently it just burns again.
It's not good, and it's why we're seeing this devastation in the West. And
smoke all the way to Europe as a result.
Wow. Wow. And now you know. Well, Greg, thank you so much for
good
being
to be
on.
With you.
We're going to miss
you.
And of course, we're going to miss you up here. Okay. Been a big leader on ENC, chairman of ENC, now ranking member. You will be missed quite a bit. And yeah. Thank you for your service.
Thank you for yours. Appreciate it.